Hello again, and welcome to episode 6 of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Vanderark. I'm the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website. And once again, we're going to do a little wandering through Harry Potter canon, digging up a few things about Book 1 and Book 2, and we'll wander even farther afield than that tonight. Before we keep going and start looking at the books again, I did want to talk a little bit about Pottermore. Apparently some people are already getting admitted in. I've had some reports coming back that some people have had a chance to view the site. I haven't gotten my letter yet, but looking forward to that, obviously, very, very much. According to the blog, there is a Pottermore blog. According to the blog, there will be a beta feedback button so that those of us that are kind of previewing for the next month or so will have an opportunity to kind of give some feedback, say things that we really liked or that we thought worked well, or I guess things that didn't seem to work well, etc. So I'm really looking forward to getting a chance to do that. I had an email from someone who was referring to a photograph that turned up in Entertainment Weekly, and I did pull it up online. And that photograph shows all sorts of background information about McGonagall. And this is what the part of what that, or it wasn't an email, what the message said. It's so exciting that the lexicon's going to be updated with all the new info. According to an image from Entertainment Weekly, McGonagall's page needs a massive update. And that's an interesting point. I've had a number of people make comments wondering about what we're going to be doing on the lexicon with regards to the information from Pottermore. And let me just say, this decision was made already in 2001 of how we deal with information like this. This is when Fantastic Beasts came out, and that book, a large portion of it is essentially an encyclopedia. It has alphabetized listings of magical creatures, and when I saw that, I had to make a decision of how we were going to deal with that on the lexicon. And the reason a decision had to be made is because the Harry Potter Lexicon website, and the book as well, they've always been a companion resources to go along with the books. I mean, you'd never read the Harry Potter Lexicon website instead of reading the Harry Potter books. I mean, that would make no sense. What makes the Harry Potter books so wonderful is that they're a story. They're not an encyclopedia. They're a story. And as a resource to be a companion to those stories, the lexicon alphabetizes information and tries to get all the canon information it can and pull it together and put it all in one place. And that's because the books themselves, the novels, do not offer that kind of a resource. And so that's where the lexicon came in. The lexicon, again, both the website and the book are designed to be companion works. You wouldn't read the lexicon book instead of the Harry Potter books. It just wouldn't. That'd be kind of ludicrous. So, however, when Fantastic Beasts came out, because a large portion of that was already an encyclopedia, was already in, that kind of, shall we say, fictional fact form. If we would reproduce all of that information, we would not be a companion to that. We would actually be a replacement. And it's never been the goal of the lexicon to be a replacement for the Harry Potter books. It's always been the goal to be to add to the enjoyment and the pleasure of reading them by providing that back that. That resource. And so back in 2001, I decided I'm not going to include all of the information from Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them on the lexicon. Because even if I would include it all reworded, it would still essentially mean that somebody wouldn't have to get Fantastic Beasts, because all they'd have to do is read the information online. And in that way, the lexicon website would become a replacement for the book. And so that was the decision that was made. And in fact, if you go to the bestiary now, you'll see there is a little icon which looks like the cover of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And we've put that icon next to any entry which comes from Fantastic Beasts, basically saying, go to that original source and you'll find all sorts of, you know, more information. We just kind of put the basic information in there. And it's, you know, the lexicon did that. There's a lot of websites out there which just basically reproduce the information from Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, essentially, if not word for word, basically with just slightly reworded. And, you know, that is simply not what the lexicon's about. We do not do that. And so that same policy applies to Pottermore. If you have a page like the one that you can see in Entertainment Weekly, which gives background information about McGonagall and her parents and her upbringing and things like this, if we just reproduce that, even if we reword it, if we just reproduce that, all of that information, the lexicon would become a replacement for going to Pottermore. Now, we're not talking about a financial thing here of who's making money or whatever. We're just talking about what's right. We don't want to be a replacement for anything that Rowling does. So we don't want to be a replacement for Pottermore any more than we want to be a replacement for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. So we will include... I will put some basic information on there, some of the new basic facts, but I'm not going to put the full backstory. I'm not going to put every tiny little detail, and I will put something to basically say, go to Pottermore and find out for yourself, because that's what a companion work should do. Now, some people might say, then we have to go to the trouble of digging it up in the Pottermore site. Well, that's good. I don't see that as trouble. I see that as fun. So I hope you enjoy finding it on there, and you'll see some basic information on the lexicon, but no, we're not going to put every tiny little detail that Pottermore has on it on our site. We are going to be a companion website for Pottermore, just like we are a companion website and a book for the Harry Potter books. So let's move on. Lots of fun stuff to talk about. I talked about the timeline recently and talked through kind of the sweep of history, if you will, and how that created the milieu for the stories, how it created the underlying prejudices and not just in the blood status question, but also between the various races and so, and how much of that has basis in the timeline, in the history that we get from the famous wizard cards, from Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, to some extent from the Harry Potter novels, but more from those other sources, and how they really contribute to this world that the stories take place in, and really add depth and a real, I don't know, enjoyment for me to kind of see how this is all developed. And I stopped at about 1750, actually, and I'm going to bump ahead a little bit and just talk a little bit more about the timeline, because we're going to talk about the first half of the 20th century, starting with Dumbledore's birth, which is 1881. But then moving ahead, what we have going on, and the reason I'm bringing this up only is because, it is interesting, but also just because I would love to read some fan fiction that takes place in this time frame, because McGonagall was born in 1925, approximately. Tom Riddle was born in 26, Hagrid in 28, Sirius Black's father in 29, and which means that in 1937, McGonagall and Sirius Black's mother, Walpurga Black, started Hogwarts. And so you could imagine McGonagall and Walpurga Black almost, I'm assuming she was a Slytherin, McGonagall was a Gryffindor. And so the two of them would have been the Harry and Draco of that time. And then the next year, Tom Riddle comes to Hogwarts. And so just imagine this. McGonagall is a second year. Tom Riddle is a first year. Probably, knew each other. And certainly knew of each other. I mean, there's only, 300 kids at Hogwarts. You certainly would know each other over the years. And then, of course, in 1940, Hagrid comes, and in 41, Sirius Black's father, Orion, comes to Hogwarts. So imagine this all happening. Imagine that, McGonagall and Walpurga Black are the older, a couple of years older, and Hagrid and Orion are coming in a couple of years later. Then Tom Riddle opens the Chamber of Secrets in 43 and creates his first Horcrux. Hagrid gets expelled. All of this is the story of Hogwarts in the, late 1930s, early 1940s. And, of course, the whole kind of culmination of it all, when Riddle leaves Hogwarts in 1945, Dumbledore defeats Grindelwald. All of that happens right about then. So we've got this whole, we don't see much, but we have this little inkling of the story that's going on at that time, which I find fascinating. And just in case you are thinking about writing fan fiction of that, the teachers at that time would have been Horace Slughorn, would have been the potions master, Albus Dumbledore teaching Transfiguration, Galatea Merrythought was Defense Against the Dark Arts, Sylvanus Kettleburn was Care of Magical Creatures, Herbert Beery was Herbology, and Armando Dippet was the headmaster. Of course, we don't have all the teachers there, but there's enough to kind of fill out an interesting little story that was going on at that time. So I just find that completely fascinating, the idea that what was going on at the school at that time, and how, again, those people and their interactions and all of the things that made up their story translate to the 1990s, which is when Harry comes to Hogwarts, and all this, a lot of those people are still involved, or their children and things like this. So fascinating to see that all. And again, this is all part of the history of the Harry Potter story, history which is not laid out exactly. It's not handed to us, but it's when you kind of work it out and figure out the dates, you kind of see this opening up in front of you, and it's fascinating. And of course, we could go on from there. We could go into the 50s and the 60s and the rise of Voldemort and so. But I think this is enough for right now. Again, we talked before about whether the famous wizard cards should be included as canon. Some of this information from what I was just talking about comes from the Black Family Tree, which again, it clearly is from J.K. Rowling. I mean, she wrote it, and definitely I would consider that to be canon. So, again, just gives an example of how some of these other sources add to the richness of the world that Rowling created. I'm just going to talk about a few odds and ends. This is, again, I'd like to pick up the lexicon book and just kind of open it up, and now I'm in the letter B, and just pull up a few things and just make a few comments and look at things a little bit. One of the things that struck me as I was doing that was the basilisk, and I am, of course, reading Chamber of Secrets, but I actually, because I'm writing notes at the same time, I haven't even gotten to the basilisk part yet, but interesting. The basilisk that we see in the books and in the films as well certainly is not the same as the basilisk from folklore. There's some strong similarities, but it's not the same. The folk tale version or the legendary version of the basilisk, and there are actually a variety of descriptions of what the basilisk supposedly looks like. One of them is that it's a small poisonous snake. In other words, that it's a kind of a grotesque mutant chicken thing, which I think comes from the fact that the basilisk in folklore was hatched from a serpent's egg placed under a rooster. No, it's a rooster, not a hen, which I'm not sure how you get the rooster to sit on it, but I guess that's the trick. That's what makes it magical. Originally created by Herpo the Fowl, I mentioned that before, but that's, again, this whole idea that already thousands of years ago there are things happening which influence the story now, the source of Horcruxes and basilisks. So this basilisk was had in folklore had the capability of breathing fire, of had the deadly stare, which would kill people. Again, people weren't getting petrified; they were getting killed. But and it could wither plants, I guess, from its breath. So that's kind of the basilisk from folklore. And like the centaurs that I mentioned before, Rowling borrows the idea of the centaur, some of the characteristics, and puts her own twist on it. I always thought, though, the basilisk was traveling around through Hogwarts through the pipes, right? But the size of the basilisk, when we finally meet the thing, what kind of pipes do they have at Hogwarts which would allow that large of a serpent to crawl through them? Now maybe I'm thinking of the film, and maybe if I read the book and try to forget the film, maybe it won't seem quite as big to me, but I can't imagine what sort of plumbing or pipes they have which would allow the basilisk of that size to be able to travel around the castle. But I guess it's a magical creature. Maybe it can change its size to some extent. A couple other things. Birdie Bots. Oh, yes, Birdie Bots. When I read that, it reminds me. my favorite Birdie Bots thing is what we call Birdie Bot Shots, and I have many fan friends who have their version of Birdie Bot Shots, and basically my favorite way of doing it is everybody chooses a Birdie Bot's bean and puts it on their forehead so they can't see what the flavor is, and then everybody else can see what it is, and you'll see people laughing and pointing and thinking, oh dear, here it goes, and then you have to eat it and try to guess. And we would do this at the film premieres. We would sit there with a bag of these things, and we'd have eight of us in a row sitting there, and we'd do Birdie Bot Shots. We'd all take one out, and those crazy things you do when you're waiting for the premiere of the next film. Favorite flavors of mine, I would have to say grass, believe it or not, and sardine. I like sardine a lot. It's kind of bizarre, but I do. And pepper. Vomit, sorry, can't get used to that one. There's some other ones too that I've not so great, but I do really like grass. So if you got any extra grass ones, and I'm all out, and I haven't been able to get any new ones. Another one, the bridge, the Brockdale Bridge, that was destroyed in the beginning of when the war is heating up at the beginning of the Death Eaters, in the film, the Death Eaters are all kind of flying around it and things like this, which we'll talk about in a minute. But the Brockdale Bridge, of course, is what it is in the books. But the bridge that they actually show in the film is the Millennium Bridge in London. And what I find, I immediately thought of this because I lived in London for a while and have walked over that bridge. And it was, when it was first built, it was known as the Wobbly Bridge because it was so shaky. People would go across it and it would kind of get a wobble to it. And so I think it's kind of interesting that the filmmakers decided to show that bridge as not only wobbly, but actually, crashing into the water. I did notice that they, very nicely didn't show any people falling in the film. But that bridge actually opened the Millennium Bridge actually opened in 2000, so it wasn't even there when the actual events of that book were happening. But I guess we will forgive them that, because it is fun to see these kind of known landmarks kind of get attacked by flying Death Eaters. And it's funny, I had an email exchange with somebody who couldn't understand why I had a problem with the Death Eaters flying in the films, according to Quidditch Through the Ages, it says no spell yet devised enables wizards to fly unaided in human form, and that's all there is to it. Now the Death Eaters, starting already in Order of the Phoenix, are flying. And so that is not canon. That is something they made up for the films. And it sounds great. I mean, you go all the way back to Quirrell in the first film was kind of would fly short distances, but so Death Eaters are flying around, but that is definitely not canon, to the point where, remember that after the Battle of the Seven Potters, when they all managed to get back to the Burrow, those that survived, one of the things they said was Voldemort could fly, and they were shocked because up until that point, nobody was able to fly without some sort of broomstick or something like this. And then Snape flies later when he gets attacked and kind of jumps out the window. And again, he flies, and they're astonished, but they say, well, he must have learned that from his master. So, this is definitely something which was invented for the films. And whatever, it's fine, but just that there's definitely a non-canon thing, so don't, if you are doing a Harry Potter role-playing game or something, don't come up with people flying, because it's not something. I mean, only two people are only known to have done it, and that would be Voldemort and Snape, and the two of them are both dead, so. But they did get the geography right. If you've kind of figured out where the Leaky Cauldron is, which I have, and also where Diagon Alley would have to be. If you look where they're flying, they fly right up the Charing Cross Road, and they go right down, right through the walls, right where Diagon Alley would have to be. So they've definitely got their London geography right, which I think is pretty cool. Should talk about that sometime. I guess when we get to D, maybe I'll talk about finding Diagon Alley or the Leaky Cauldron, because anyway, that's a great story too. Moving on, we talked last time about looking at the books as one long story, as the first four books being kind of part one, the last three books being part two, and we talked about those first four books, kind of Harry creating, being created as like a superhero Harry. In books one through four, and we get to book four, and he's got all these tools to be sort of a conventional action hero, or he thinks he does, and then there's this kind of pause in the story, and then book five, and the pause is not actually in the story, the pause is in the writing. Book five, all of the things that he considered that made him powerful got ripped away. At the end, he even said he doesn't want to be Harry anymore, and then he begins this process of becoming the Harry who we see at the end of book seven. So, and we talked about that last time, and I thought I'd talk about that a little bit more, but I want to concentrate just a little bit on a couple of books, because, as I said, I'm reading Chamber of Secrets, and so just looking at book one, for example, I kind of talked a little bit about what the purpose is for book three. And in one of the podcasts, I talk about the Triwizard Tournament, why that turns up in book four in story terms, but also, you know, you can step out of the story and say that there had to be some way for Harry to be an action hero in that book, but then why Dumbledore would have revived the Triwizard Tournament at that particular point in history. What was his goal for that? And we said a couple podcasts ago that the reason was that he was countering Voldemort's way of attacking, which is to build distrust and animosity and prejudice amongst people, and feed on that. Well, Dumbledore is doing the opposite. He is fostering, good friendships between wizards of, different wizards and things like this. So we can see that the Triwizard Tournament in book four, in fact, all of book four, has a reason in the development of Harry as a character. We also talk about the kind of the purpose of book five. But let's talk very briefly about kind of what is the purpose of book one. And the key here, obviously, it is the introduction, but there's a couple of key themes that come out in book one and that kind of trace themselves through the entire saga. One of them is what I call the vision theme. As you look at the way that Harry's eyes are kind of opened a little bit more and a little bit more, I always love the title of the chapter, The Vanishing Glass. Because the glass, of course, in the snake's pen vanishes, and it doesn't come back, regardless of what they show in the film. But also you have this sense of whatever is blocking Harry's vision is vanishing, is going away, he's beginning to see more and more. That's one of the big things that we see through book one, is this development of the vision theme. And so it's interesting because, having written some pretty detailed notes about book one, I've kind of noted as these things come up, which I guess now would be a really good time to mention this kind of announcement that I said I was going to do. I have done written a new book, which is it's called the Harry Potter Lexicon Reader's Guide series. I haven't written all of them yet, the Reader's Guide books basically are stepping through each of the books with bringing up a lot of notes and details and things. It's basically a companion book to reading the book and going through kind of line by line and seeing a lot of the connections, the themes as they develop, some background information, just some little trivia here and there, a lot of the kind of things that I talk about on this podcast, but in a very systematic way going through, in this case, book one. And this book series is going to be released as ebooks. The first one is, as I said, the Harry Potter Lexicon Reader's Guide to Philosopher's Stone. That one will be coming out right around Labor Day. We're going to be making that available. Right now it's going to be published for the Kindle, but I'm looking into some other forms as well, so especially if I know there are people who are interested in that. So that will become available. I'll give you more information as we get a little bit closer. That book will be coming out. And then following about every 6 months, I'm hoping, will be the next one. And I guess I'm doing it now for a couple of reasons, one of which is that there's this kind of lot of renewed interest, and also because I've just been doing so much research when it comes to doing the podcast and just realizing how much information I do have, and I'm trying to find a way to kind of share some of that. But also with Pottermore starting up, and they're kind of working on a schedule of one book at a time, and again, I look at the Reader's Guide to be, a companion work. These things are always companion works, not replacements. I certainly could never write anything which would replace the kind of information that Rowling can give us in Pottermore, but to go through the books and to kind of just kind of pull out those themes and pull out some of those ideas. So that's what this will be, and I hope that this is something people will enjoy. So Labor Day weekend is what we're shooting for there. The book's actually finished. I've done editing it. I keep editing it, and then I keep editing it some more, and at some point I have to decide that it's really and truly finished. And then it just has to be finished getting it ready for publication and looking into some of the other formats that I might want to put it in. So that's what's going to be coming in another week or two. Hopefully another podcast in another week or two as well. But moving on. As I said, the purpose of book one is kind of to open our eyes and Harry's eyes to this world of which he is a part, to kind of get some of the background story in place, although really the more we know now about the whole saga, the more we realize just how little Rowling really does reveal to us. It's really amazing to see that happen. When you start to know it, all the things that happen, you realize just how clever she is at writing in a way that sounds like she's telling you the story, and actually she's giving us very little information. But as you're reading it, some things to kind of keep in your mind, this kind of filter idea of as you read it, what filter do you have? One thing is to watch very carefully for the machinations that of Dumbledore. What is he actually doing? Think about all through book one, what does he know? When does he know it? What is he doing? We can refer to the Princess Tale, which is toward the end of book seven, and kind of see what he was doing as far as Snape was concerned, as far as Quirrell was concerned. But at what point does he realize that we're actually dealing with Voldemort? I mean, clearly not until the very end, because if he really thought Voldemort was that close and wandering the hallways of Hogwarts, he certainly would have reacted differently than he did. So at what point did he know that? And what does he do with the Mirror of Erised? How much of that is his doing that Harry encounters that mirror and deals with that? Watch also for just for fun. Just note some of the major differences from the film. Most of them don't really matter, but it's interesting to note, especially because if you're in a situation like I am, where doing the lexicon, I still get emails from people who are pointing out what they think is an error on the lexicon because of something in the film. So a couple of the things which you see in the film, which are not canon fact, besides wizards flying, when you see Quirrell flying, James Potter was not a seeker, according to J.K. Rowling. James Potter was a chaser. And that's she has said so. It never says differently in the books, although, you know, he is seen with a snitch at some point, but it never says he was a seeker. But because it says so in the film, a lot of people have pointed out, oop, you made a mistake in the lexicon, you put the wrong thing. Well, no, I put what J.K. Rowling said. Now, it is possible that she will come back and say, well, I made a mistake when I said that, and he really was a seeker. But as of right now, when this is being recorded, she has not changed that statement. So she said he was a chaser, so James was a chaser. Another thing, Ron wasn't in the forest. He was in the hospital wing with a dragon bite. Neville was in the forest along with Draco and Harry. So these are the kind of things which, because they do it differently in the film, people don't... We'll send an email, they'll be a little confused. Why would I say it differently on the lexicon? Quirrell shaking hands with Harry. In the book, he shakes hands. But in the book, he doesn't have the turban on his head yet because he hasn't yet tried to steal the stone. And it wasn't until after stealing the stone, which was after Harry and Hagrid left Gringotts, he hasn't tried to... It was after he failed at... stealing the stone, that Voldemort actually inhabited his body. Which is interesting, because then, and this is months and months later, if you remember when Harry overhears this conversation, which he assumes is Quirrell and Snape, and Quirrell is resisting having to go do something, and it says, okay, finally, I'll do it. Okay, think about it. He's being asked to go down and get the stone in these passages under the castle. He was involved in setting up the defenses, one of which is a troll which he put there. This is nothing compared to going then trying to steal something out of a vault in Gringotts. And he seems that upset about it. So, we think that his whole stuttering and so is an act, but I think that Quirrell, by the time we get toward the end of the story of Book One, is pretty messed up. If he was willing to go try to steal a stone out of Gringotts, and then he was terrified to do some little thing like just go down and face some dangers, which a couple of first years managed to get past. But there's that. And just think about the fact that in the film, time is so compressed. The charms class with the feather is Halloween. That's 2 months after the beginning of school. And, of course, in the film, it just seems like a few days. Which, again, when you read the book, enjoy the fact that you really see the fact that Harry and Ron and Hermione just are not at all friends. I mean, they just don't like each other. And especially Ron is just totally dismissive of Hermione, hurts her feelings, and that's allowed to continue for 2 months before this troll incident happens. And the troll incident, it's not really the troll that makes them friends, it's the fact that Hermione lies to save them. You realize that? It's Hermione starting to break the rules a little bit. But it's so well done in the book. In the movie, it just seems to be just kind of flies right past. And I know films, they got to do that, but when you're reading the book, just kind of enjoy that, the fact that there is so much story in there. And then, of course, don't forget that we're talking about the fact that this book, Book One, is not all by itself. It leads directly into Book Two. And so, as you are leaving Book One, if you're going into Book Two, keep in mind Harry's situation. Harry has just fought against a dark wizard, has bested, all these terrible dangers. He's done heroic things, but he gets back to the Dursleys and immediately falls back into this timid, sad little boy who is crushed by Vernon Dursley. I mean, Vernon locks up his wand, locks up the owl. His owl is padlocked into his cage, and he just kind of from going from his saving people thing, from his hero moment, he immediately falls right back into. He's just kind of waiting pathetically. I mean, he isn't even waiting to be rescued, because when Ron and his brothers turn up in the flying car, he doesn't even assume he's being rescued. All he can do is say, let them know I'm not going to be coming back. This is the Harry who just did this heroic deed at the end of Book One, and that quickly, at the beginning of Book Two, is kind of cowed and is back to cowering, I guess, is a good word for it. But it's interesting, because now as you see that, and as you go into Book Two, and you see him having to kind of defy Vernon just a little bit and try to, by escaping and by being willing to do this and laughing about it. And then just, thinking ahead, Think about Harry at the beginning, in the beginning of book three. Think of the changes that are happening in Harry just in the way that he talks to Uncle Vernon from book to book. There was so much to talk about when it comes to book three. Book two. I've been having so much fun with that. I really have. One thing I've just got to say. Again, I'm at the beginning of book two, so I'm just kind of getting rocking in here. The diary thing. I mentioned before that one of the key moments in the story is the 700 galleon prize that Arthur Weasley wins. Well, there's another moment. This is at the beginning of book two, when again, this is one of these little throwaway moments, but if this one thing would not have happened, it would have, could very well have meant the whole entire story would have been totally different. And that is that they're heading out. They're up at dawn, and by the way, the timing of this doesn't make any sense. They're up at dawn, which on the 1st of September in 1992 was at 6:13. If you think about the fact that they're located in the West Country, and they're going to try to get to King's Cross by 11, there's no way. It would be impossible. They would have to catch the M5 and then catch the M4 at Bristol, and it would take them at least 5 or 6 hours with traffic, probably. I mean, I could maybe do it a little less, but I don't know what they were thinking, but I'm guessing that the Ford Anglia had a little more magic to it than Molly was aware, because if they got up at dawn at 6:13 and loaded everything in the car and tried to drive to King's Cross and still did, in fact, make it by 11, there had to be some magic involved. There's no way that they would have been able to do it in that amount of time without magic. So the car must have been doing the same thing the Ministry cars do and kind of jumped ahead. Arthur did say that they would make it in 10 minutes with the invisibility booster, which, again, there's no way 10 minutes short of being doing a night bus jump. There's no way that it would make it even in that 10 minutes. But be that as it may, it is sort of interesting because Ginny, they're heading for the highway. They get to the highway, and Ginny complains she's forgotten her diary. Now, you know, I've got kids. If one of my kids said, I've forgotten my diary and we're running that late, I would not go back for it. Diaries are not that important. I mean, you can get another diary or something, you know, but there's no way I would have gone back that they go back for it. Now, what if they would have not gone back for the diary? There would have been a Horcrux sitting at the Borough for the entire school year. And what? What would have happened? I mean, the diary becomes the focus of everything that happens in book two. And, of course, you know, we know when we start learning about Horcruxes that that diary is actually the focus of the part one of seven of trying to defeat Voldemort. And fascinating to think if in that one little moment of just running back and getting the diary, how that would have been different if they would have done what I would have think would be a perfectly logical parent thing to do, which is to say, well, you forgot it. You'll have to get it when you come home for Christmas. But, you know, that's just the way it is. So, for some reason, they went back, and thank goodness they did, because otherwise we would have had one more Horcrux to have to try to find and destroy. And another thing. You know, I have so much fun with this. The barrier between platforms 9 and 10. When I was living in London, I was living quite near King's Cross, and I would, when I started to write the book In Search of Harry Potter, one of the places I decided to try to find was King's Cross. In fact, I started there, and the reason I started there was because it was going to be really easy to find because, well, obviously, there are signs. it's pretty obvious when you see it. I wanted to see what it looked like between platforms 9 and 10 at King's Cross. Interesting, King's Cross is not a very magical-looking place at all. I mean, it is pretty drab, pretty plain. They're doing a big facelift of it. I haven't been there for a few years, but the last time I was there, they took out that pedestrian bridge, the one that features in the films. And I haven't seen it since, so I don't know what it looks like now. But I know that the ceiling, the roof is beautiful. It's not that, but it's not fancy. It's not an architectural wonder, that's for sure. And the funny thing is right next door is St. Pancras, which is this sort of red and gold kind of confection. It's this beautiful building. It looks like a castle or like a palace or something like this. If one of the two, I mean, these are two stations right next to each other. If one of the two was going to look like the magic one, it would be St. Pancras. And as a matter of fact, if you see the film, when the car kind of takes off, they show St. Pancras in the background, that not King's Cross. You don't ever actually see King's Cross in the films, I don't believe. You are always seeing St. Pancras. And so I live near there, and when I was writing the book, I decided, okay, this should be an easy one. I'm going to go and try to find the platforms 9 and 10 at King's Cross, and I should be able to get a good sense of it. And so I went looking, and as a matter of fact, obviously I went into the big train shed, the big, huge concourse there where all the trains are, and there's no platforms 9 and 10. They aren't there. It goes through 8. And in order to find platforms, I mean, there is a 9 and 10, but it's not even in that big train shed. You have to go kind of down to the side and off to, and it's almost a separate building. And sure enough, there's platforms 9, 10, 11, and I think 12. I have to double check on that. But there's just a few more kind of short lines that come in on the side there. So platforms 9 and 10 are not by the rest of it's not in that big huge area that you see in the films. And important to note, and this is kind of what I was driving at, if you read closely in book 2 where it describes the barrier is not stone. It's not described as a stone wall as you see in the film at all, or an archway or anything like that. It's a metal barrier. And if you go to King's Cross and you look, it's sure enough, it's a metal, like a bumper barrier or a horizontal, I don't know, fence kind of a thing. And if you look in the book, it says that there's a ticket box in between. And sure enough, between platforms 9 and 10, there is a ticket box right in between, right about where you would have to go walking through. So if you actually go there, you're not going to find that platforms 9 and 10 look anything like what you see in the films. You're actually going to find exactly what's described in the books, a metal barrier with a ticket box in between. And so do go. It's great fun. It's fun to stand there and think, oh, man, if I just kind of run right through that. I don't advise actually doing it because you will hurt yourself, I promise. But they did choose a stone archway. You've probably seen pictures of this. They're all over the place, where they've cut a luggage trolley in half and actually fastened it to the wall to make it look like it's halfway through, and put a sign above it saying platform 9 3/4. So that is there in King's Cross, although they moved it, I understand, because of the renovations they were doing. And again, I haven't been there since the move happened, but from what I've been told, it's moved to kind of, at least when from the last I heard, it wasn't anywhere near even as cool looking as what they had set up before. But still worth a trip to King's Cross just to see that beautiful train shed roof, and also to kind of see if you can find platforms 9 and 10. Rowling did say that she was thinking of, in her mind, when she was imagining it, she was imagining, she realized later what she was seeing in her head was actually Euston Station, which is a couple of miles down the road. And is also very muggle and very boring and not particularly pretty to look at. But either way, it is great fun. If you go to London, you got to make sure you do stop there and do take a look and see what platforms 9 and 10 really do look like, because it's not going to look like what you expect. But it does look exactly like what's described in book 2. So we'll talk next time a little bit more about book 2, because as I say, I'm having some fun going through there. We'll spend a little more time on that, and hopefully have had a chance at that point maybe to get into Pottermore and talk a little bit more about some of that information. So that's coming up. Look for another podcast, hopefully in about a week to 2 weeks. Some of you know that I'm actually in my spare time. I'm a school teacher, which means this time of year, as we get towards September, I get busier and busier. So my goal is to still be able to do a podcast about every 2 weeks, and that's what I'm shooting for. And again, right around Labor Day, hopefully we'll have that the first book of the Reader's Guide series will be out. Oh, and just a note, it shares the name of the Reader's Guides on the Lexicon website, and there's some similarities to it, but it is not the same information, or it is not that information simply copied over into an electronic book. I actually started, basically didn't go back to the website, but I actually kind of went at it with fresh eyes. And the reason is because the Reader's Guides on the Lexicon website were written before we had all the books, and so a lot of it is perfectly fine, but some of it's out of date or is speculation because we didn't know yet how things were going to end up. And so I just decided to kind of write it all from scratch, and so that's what is going to be in the book. So it's similar. I borrowed the name, I guess, because I just really like that name. And there will be a whole series of these. So again, that's coming out around Labor Day, and hopefully another podcast right before then as well. So I guess, do go to the Lexicon website, and the address is www.hp-lexicon.org. Doing updates whenever I can on there, kind of working on things. Also, if you go to that and then click on the podcast link up at the top, you can go to the show notes for this episode. And for the other episodes. If you want to contact me, my email address is steve.lexicon@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, lexicon_Steve. Go to the Facebook fan page. I'll put a link to that on there as well. Keep posting trivia and other little things on there. It's kind of fun. We get some conversations going, which is always great. That about does it for episode 6. I'll start getting my notes together as soon as I can for episode 7. And in the meantime, waiting for Pottermore to open up. It's kind of like waiting for the Hogwarts letter, isn't it? As always, this is Steve Vander Ark, and thank you for listening.